Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody to Paranexus Universe. Today is Thursday, June 10th, 2010. This is your host, Doug Kelly, and I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Grant Rubendunst.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, and happy Thursday evening.
Yes, indeed. And, of course, behind the scenes, we have our producer call screener, John Rossi, who is with us tonight, and we're glad to have him, too. So
behave yourself, or the button will come down.
The almighty
right,
John button. Yes,
that's
John's,
right, man.
John's muted right now, but he is listening to us, so we can say anything we want about him, and he can't say anything back.
But he could, yeah, and he can't cut us off either. So
that's right. Well, actually, he could, because he's
he
got
He probably
switchboard.
Could, yeah, you're right.
Okay, be nice.
Plug on us all, down we go. Yeah, sorry, John.
All right, so if you want to call in tonight to ask questions, you're more than welcome. Numbers there on your screen, 347-945-7799. You can also ask questions in the chat room. Our guest tonight is Steve Parsons from the UK, and Steve has quite a past in paranormal research. He's been on a number of documentaries and involved in a number of shows, including Most Haunted and others, and we'll let him tell us more about that. Steve, welcome to Paranexus Universe.
So Hi, nice to have you.
I don't know whether to say good morning, good evening, good night, but hello.
Yeah, Steve is kind enough to remain up. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning for him over there, so he's very kind, or he's just absolutely nuts. One of those two.
Well, if I'm nuts,
you know,
it's
the latter, not the
latter. We work nights.
This is true. There's no getting around that.
So tell us about your background. I mean, I've got your bio. I could read it, but I think it'd be more interesting coming from you. You've been involved in quite a bit.
Yeah, started, I think, as a kid. We always have an interest, I think. Most children have an interest in being scared and ghosts and paranormal. But I think really it started in my teens when a friend of mine, we visited a haunted house together. I think we were just really curious more than anything. But about 15 years ago, after being involved in a local paranormal group, myself and my colleague in parascience decided that there was only really one way of answering the questions that we were asking, and that was to establish our own team and to approach it using scientific methods and techniques. And by science, I don't mean lots of qualifications, although I do have qualifications. I mean using scientific methods, that's observation and recording and documenting, doing it methodically, doing it slowly, and understanding the steps that we're making. So we set up a group, we called it Parascience, and we've been hard at it ever since, looking at, really for the explanations.
How many folks do you have in your group, Steve?
The group has only ever, it's always been a small group. We've never really exceeded 15 people because we found that with the previous group that we were both members of, as the group got bigger, it started to fall apart into factions. People wanted to do their own things. Belief was different as regards method. And so the group inevitably starts to fall apart. In fact, I think it's probably certainly in the UK, fair to say that most groups, we have over 2,000 over here,
wow,
have formed from a factional split between, from an earlier group.
That would make sense.
Yeah, and I think that runs true over here,
keep
too.
It small. Keep it small.
We couldn't agree with you more because, we started off with more people in a group, and then, about maybe a year and a half ago, Steve, we decided that we wanted it small because we kind of felt that if there was anything there, when you get 15 or 10 people tramping through there, if, the paranormal is as elusive as it has been, it's gone, or it's going to completely recede. So we've reduced our investigation staff to about 3 people.
I think that's the best way. When we go on an investigation, I always try to take the minimum number of people possible, given the location size.
Mm-hmm.
But the team currently has 16 members, and that means that we can field, allowing for jobs and family commitments, mm-hmm, we can field between 4 and 8 per location, which is a good number to use.
Mm-hmm.
We like to keep the teams working in pairs as well. So... it gives us a good number to work with, and they're a great team. They come; they have a huge background. We have housewives, we have students, we have professionals. Because what we're looking for are just normal people's experiences, the everyday experiences that people report. And we also try and make sure that when we go on an investigation, it might sound a little bit crazy, but we try to make sure that the team isn't ghost hunting, because the cases we're investigating, the original witnesses weren't ghost hunting when they had their experience. And so it's important for us to try and recreate the original experience in order to test it, to find out whether the original witnesses' experiences were valid. And so if we send a group of people in who are ghost hunting, we've immediately already changed the scenario.
Interesting. So you've done some research with infrasound, correct?
That's correct. It's part of my PhD research, looking at the interest in infrasound and the paranormal really kicked off in the late 1990s when a British researcher highlighted the potential link between infrasound, which I don't know if everybody understands, but infrasound is... I think we're all familiar with a dog whistle and the fact that the frequency is extremely high and we can't hear the sound. Well, infrasound is the same but very, very low frequency sound. It's sound below the range that normal humans can hear.
So what hertz level would you put that at?
It's difficult to actually define it, but the standard definition is sound below about 20 hertz in frequency.
Wow, that is low. No doubt about that.
It's incredibly low, but there are, you can actually hear sound that low, and that's why there is this difficulty trying to define it, because...
Are there any sources, Steve, that would naturally occur in nature that would cause those type of low frequency, or would emanate that kind of low frequency?
It's all around you. If we were to measure the infrasound right now where you are, it would be pretty loud. The causes would be the jet stream in the atmosphere, wind, vehicles, volcanoes, ocean surf if you live near the beach. All forms of man-made activity generate this very low frequency sound. And if you live in a big city and you could hear the infrasound, and probably fortunately you can't, on a decibel scale it would be nearly as loud as a jet engine.
Well, if I remember my physics right, usually the sine wave with lower frequencies is longer and wider and more sustaining, correct?
That's correct. The infrasound has a frequency and wavelength that can be tens of kilometers to hundreds of kilometers in length. It just passes straight through buildings and objects as if they're not there. It's immensely powerful, and it's only really been since the dawning of the moonshots that we really began to understand the effects of infrasound on human beings. And then only in the late 1990s was a link made between paranormal experiences and infrasound.
I think I recall reading about that. And it has adverse physical effects on folks, correct?
It does, but let's nail a myth right now. Infrasound has been associated with something called the brown note, a frequency, according to the story, the frequency of 7 hertz would cause the bowels to spontaneously evacuate. Hence,
that
it's called
sucks.
The brown note. It's been tested, and it doesn't. You're quite safe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I know, just to digress a little bit, I know that the United States military has already been fiddling around with sound waves as to use for crowd dispersal. So, that brown wave may be something that they're probably planning on, because I think that if I was in a crowd raising hell and I had one of that something like that happened to me, I'm going home.
Well, I think we all would, but the military have been playing around with sound for a long, long time as a non-lethal weapon. Both the US military, the UK military, Europeans have also, and it has actually, we do have sonic weapons now in use. We have a device called the LRAD, which stands for Long Range Acoustic Device, which is used primarily Iraq and in Afghanistan, and also on ships to keep the Somali pirates at bay. But that doesn't use infrasound as such. Currently, there are no known infrasonic weapons.
What's the difference between ELFs and infrasound, or is there?
The definition, extremely low frequency, normally would apply to an electromagnetic field. You would have an ELF, electromagnetic field, but with a sound wave, it's normally defined as infrasound.
So let me ask you this. We had another guest on in the past and talking a little bit about infrasound, and he, if I remember correctly, Grant, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but he seemed to indicate that it was pretty much impossible to measure infrasound or to record. Maybe what he was referring to is to record potential EVPs in the infrasound range, if I remember correctly. Any comments on that, or have you been able to?
Certainly we have to be able to measure infrasound, both as from the paranormal perspective, but also as part of my PhD research. And in fact, as part of that research program, I designed a system called ARID, which stands for Acoustic Research Infrasound Detector, which is a portable infrasound spectrum analysis real-time system that allows us to measure and document the infrasound at haunted locations throughout the UK and Europe. We also have an adjacent system to it called ARIA, which is an infrasound emitter system. And we've used that in a number of experiments at haunted locations. And it can generate quite powerful amounts of infrasound, which we can use to expose people to and to test their reactions. So it is incredibly difficult to measure infrasound. And I would be very, very skeptical of groups that say we have recorded infrasound without seeing their equipment list or how they're doing it. There are lots of groups over here that claim to be recording infrasonic EVP, but when you actually look at the equipment they're using, they're clearly not doing that.
So have you been able to do that?
Certainly I can record infrasound. I've recorded hundreds and hundreds of hours of infrasound at haunted locations, but no EVPs. I've never seen anything unusual or unexpected apart from the infrasound itself. I've never seen an infrasonic EVP.
What do you make of that? I mean, what's your thinking on that, your hypothesis, why?
Because I'm not seeing anything I'm not expecting, because I'm not expecting. EVP is something different. EVP research is a fascinating subject area, and it's a worthy area of study. But to link EVP and infrasound, it's just stringing two similar phenomena together and saying, well, you know, that sound and that sound, therefore, you know, you can't hear infrasound, you can't hear EVP, there must be a correlation between the two. And that just isn't the case, I don't think.
Hmm. So have you, you've done some typical EVP research, though?
Yes, we've been involved with the Frank's Box, with which is over in the States. You'll know all about Frank's Box. Mm-hmm. We've also had another system being tested over here using the original Raudiva system. Konstantin Raudiva, who was one of the pioneers of early EVP research and wrote the book Breakthrough, used... claimed to have amazing EVP results using, instead of replacing the microphone on the recorder system, he replaced it with a simple germanium diode. And we've been testing his claims by replicating that system using a germanium diode instead of the microphone attachments.
Hmm.
It's an interesting area of study, and it's a very contentious area of study, EVP. There are a lot of claims made about EVP. Lots of groups go out there and they come back and they say, we've got all these extraordinary recordings. Whether they're actually recordings of something paranormal or whether they're just hearing sounds within the white noise, within the auto gain systems of the recorders... at this stage, we don't know. My partner in parascience, Anne, has recently completed a dissertation as part of her BSc studies, Bachelor of Science studies, which is actually looking at exactly that, in a laboratory, playing snatches of clean white noise and white noise intermixed with random and chopped up human speech, to see if people can actually detect the sound, or whether they just hear noises within the white noise, hear words within the white noise.
Like, you mean like apophenia or apophenia rather, or pareidolia or matrixing?
Exactly that. We don't really have any reliable way of testing the results for EVP, of testing the recordings. We can look at them with spectrum analysis, but often the recording qualities that were given to analyze are very poor. And so really we are only left with a subjective test. And one good way of doing it is we, with some recordings we have tried, is we take a group of 10, 20 people, and we tend to pick people who have got nothing at all, no interest in the paranormal. And we sit them down and we say, here, I'll have a listen to this. Tell us what you think. We don't tell them it's a voice. We don't tell them what's there. And we see if there's a consensus. If everybody says there's a woman on there shouting, help, let me out, I'm trapped. Well, that would be very, very interesting. But generally, you play it with 20 people, you'll get 20 responses.
Hmm.
20 different responses, Steve?
20 different responses.
Yeah, that kind of washes everything. You know, I would be inclined to think that what would happen would be people might say something like, I didn't hear anything. Because I think that once you contaminate, because, you know, it's just this in my experience, and I'm sure you'll agree, that once somebody says something, you know, like, that sounds like such and such, then everybody gets it.
That's exactly right. There's an old saying that goes back a long time. It's not related, but it's relevant. In order to curse somebody, you have to tell them that they've been cursed. Well, with EVP... for somebody to hear an EVP, you have to tell them what they're going to listen to.
Yeah, absolutely.
The original research done for Breakthrough back in the 1960s and by other researchers since is intriguing, and I'm not going to dismiss it, and I'm going to continue to study the subject. But at the moment, I don't think that we know enough about EVP, and I don't think necessarily we know how to interpret the results.
Have you scanned for, filtered for human speech frequencies to rule that out?
We can look at it with a spectrum analyzer, and we can see the frequencies of human speech. But the problem is, once you start filtering, once you start playing with the sound recording, you are changing it, and so you're not dealing with the original file, and you end up in a situation where you're trying to deal with your own artifacts. You've started to filter stuff. We don't have the technology. We're not CSI. We don't have the facilities that a police forensic audio analysis lab would have. And we're not going to get these guys to help either. So at the moment, they're too busy making television programs in Miami and New York. I'd love some of that kit, boys. I'd love some of that kit. They're 30 years ahead of the rest of the world.
Yeah, true enough.
In fact, they're 30 years ahead of reality.
Yeah.
So, have you captured any EVPs that you cannot explain?
I think inevitably, the amount of time that we've been ghost hunting out in the field, we do have a number of recordings that we can't comfortably explain. That doesn't mean to say that they're paranormal, but what is interesting is that out of all of the recordings we've got, and we have hundreds of thousands of hours of recordings, there have been literally tens of seconds. We have maybe 10, 20 seconds of audio out of all those thousands of hours that are still intriguing and baffling and that we can't explain. And we revisit time and time again to look at and to listen to try and see if we can understand what took place. Perhaps the most intriguing and interesting, it counts as an EVP because it was recorded, but it was also heard at the time of recording. This took place in an old school. The building was about 150 years old. We were there with it had been converted into a business centre. And we were there with our own team plus people from the business centre. So there were about 17 people in the building. We had about 12 cameras set up, video cameras that were sound recording at the same time. And we have eight and a half minutes of schoolyard noise, children running, doors opening, laughing, shouting, singing. It was heard by every person in the building, and it was recorded by every sound recorder in the building.
Wow.
We've never explained that. We spent months trying to recreate that scenario afterwards.
That's very interesting.
That especially, really is.
Especially that you heard it and recorded it. Of course, you know, hearing it would imply that it would be recorded if it was an audible sound. Well, that there's a question in the chat room from Sharon. How do you think, this is directed at you, Steve, how do you think spirits could speak in an audible way without vocal cords or breath? In other words, I think she's asking, gee, if they're spirits, how do they make audible sounds?
Well, that is a really good question, because I approach it, I would approach that question by breaking that question up. Hi Sharon, by the way, if Sharon hears a noise and Sharon is the only person who hears a noise, then there are two possibilities. Either she heard it and nobody else did, or the noise was within Sharon's brain or within her ear structures. It was an internal sound.
Are you talking telepathic?
No, it can be explained quite normally by the... I'm sure a lot of people have heard the name or heard a loud noise as they fall asleep or drift off to sleep. So that would be quite a normal thing and quite a real event for somebody. If it was recorded, if the sound was recorded, then clearly air is moving.
Yes.
For that sound to be recorded. And this is why we break it up. So we now have air in motion. In order for the air to be in motion, something started the air molecules moving. So something physical moved and started to push the air molecules. And that's what we start looking for. So in answer to Sharon's question, if ghosts and spirits can speak in an audible way, they must be using something instead of vocal cords and breath, some physical device or mechanism to drive the air forward.
Yeah, that would stand to reason. So many people feel that they have gotten EVPs, and yet you've taken hundreds of thousands of hours, you say, of recordings, but only been left with a few seconds of something you can't explain. So what is everybody getting, in your opinion?
Well, they're getting a good night, a good scare.
Yeah.
Well, I always question the television programs and the paranormal groups who make these claims for having so much evidence, because it should be incredibly rare. The paranormal, if it's there at all, and I do believe that we still have a great deal to explain, should be incredibly rare. We might encounter it once or twice, occasionally, sometimes, and more often than not, never. So I think a few seconds of audio, one or two snatches of video, perhaps one or two photographs in the 20 years we've been doing it is a good average. And I would be deeply skeptical of groups that come back with 10 or 15 photographs and hundreds of EVPs every time they go out.
Well, there's a lot of orb photos.
Yeah, well, if they want to photograph dust, that's keeps them happy, I suppose.
You've done some experiments that way?
Yeah, orbs, they're almost... I would like to have invented the orb killer gun, shoot the little varmints, but we had to wait a long time in order to get the orbs killed off. We first started noticing them back in the late 90s. Parascience was using night vision video. I don't think we were the first, but we were certainly early users of both night vision video and digital photography. And we started to see these moving objects on the video, and we saw the what are now the classical orbs on the digital photography. But we started to see them a lot. We started to see them on almost every investigation we went on. And that was the point when we started to realize that if they're that common, they're not going to be paranormal. And so we decided that we really need to try and understand what was happening and what we were dealing with. So we set up a project that downloaded from the internet, I think around 10,000 digital photographs, where we had the original file name to work with. So we were looking for people who had uploaded their pictures to the web, pictures that had been taken by flash, and where we knew the make and model of the camera from the data file or the file numbering. And we discovered that there were literally a very high chance. If you took a flash photograph with a digital camera, you were going to get a picture of an orb. Now, we then spoke to the camera makers, the camera manufacturers. They already had realized that this phenomenon existed. One or two of them had put stuff on their own websites about it. And we put the results of our early experiments onto the Parascience website. People want to go and have a read of it. It's on www.parascience.org.uk.
Hey, you plugged your site. Good for you.
Yeah.
Say it again.
www.parascience.org.uk. So let people go and have a look at that. But that was all we could do. We didn't kill the orb. We said, here is what's happening. This is how orbs are being made. It's all perfectly normal. Don't let's build them up into anything, you know, too spooky. But people decided, no, we've seen them on TV. We've got them on our cameras. If we zoom in, we can see faces in them. There are pink ones for girls and blue ones for boys. And there's
books. Oh, yeah, we've heard that.
There is books, how to contact your inner angel using orbs, and but
don't
we always knew. We always knew that there was a final experiment that needed to be done, but the technology wasn't right until last year when Fujifilm brought out the stereo digital camera. And that meant that we could take two absolutely identical pictures simultaneously. And when I say identical, I don't just mean identical in that we press the shutter at the same time and you get to see pictures. The software that writes the image, the imaging chip, the lens systems, the software compression systems are all absolutely identical for the stereo left and right pair. So if we had the orb on one side of the picture and we had no orb on the corresponding opposite picture, then clearly it was a piece of dust very close to the lens being lit up by the flash.
And go ahead.
We took the camera out literally the second shot we took with the camera gave us our first orb. We took it all over the UK and Ireland, and it led to some quite interesting moments because the camera doesn't look particularly different from a standard digital camera, and we didn't tell anybody what we were doing. We were just snapping along digitally like everybody else was, and they were getting orbs, we were getting orbs. And at one investigation in Wicklow Jail in Ireland, the medium who was leading the investigation was communicating with the spirit of a little girl called Annie. As I took the shot, I said, "Oh, great orb." He asked to have a look at it on the camera screen, and he looked at the picture and he assured me that that was Annie.
Mm-hmm.
Except when you look at the digital pair, Annie's only on one side of the picture. So poor Annie had been Annie the ghost was a bit of dust.
Yeah. So have you ever gotten orbs on both sides?
We certainly do. We get orbs on both sides, left and right, all of the time, but they're never in the same place.
That's interesting.
So we've never had a corresponding anomaly appear on the left and right side.
Oh, good.
The camera has, I think, definitively, absolutely, finally nailed the orb. But I say that, and then only a few weeks ago when we published the results online, we had a message, an email sent to us saying, "I've read your research. It's fascinating. I know most orbs are dust, but if you have a look at one of the pictures you uploaded, if you zoom in on it, you can see a face."
Uh-huh.
I think you may have caught some paranormal orbs.
Uh-huh.
And then one guy messaged us and said that the reason why they only appear on one side of the stereo pair is because they are paranormal. So you're never ever going to finally, I don't think...
Well, the power of belief says it all, doesn't it?
Exactly. The power of teaching says a lot.
Yeah,
you know,
people convince themselves. It's self-denial, and it's a lot of, it's their power, essentially the power of belief. They want to believe it so badly. We've had people that, you'll tell them, and of course this runs true all the way across the board with people's belief systems. You tell them something, and they completely refute it.
It's not that I don't really think it's that person's fault either. It's one of education.
No. Yeah.
They really don't know any better. Years ago, I'm sitting here surrounded by hundreds of books on the subject of ghosts, many of them written in the early part of the 20th century, guys like Harry Price, who was a celebrity ghost hunter. He was a best-selling author. Everybody loved to hear Harry's stories about the ghosts. Then comes along TV, and people realize quite quickly that, hey, you don't have to be anything special to be a ghost hunter. You just need a few friends, a night out, a spooky location, maybe a camera, maybe a sound recorder, and look at the results these guys on television are getting.
Yeah.
Anybody can be a ghost hunter.
Yeah. And we lost sight of science. The science, you know, most people don't even know the basic, they don't even know how to conduct a basic experiment. And yet they're out there saying we have definitive proof, you know.
Well, there's a lot of ghost hunters out there who are using EMF meters, and when we've met them at events and at conferences and said, can you explain what an electromagnetic field is? It's an energy field that's emitted by a ghost.
Really?
Now, that's what's really scary.
That's very scary. But it's because we live in this instant culture where we want it now, we want it large, and we don't want to wait around to read the research. We're led by the media often. I mean, infrasound started the same way. There was some studies done with looking back at the infrasonic weapons and how they can have effects on people, and the media took hold of it, and there were some astonishing headlines at the time. Infrasound was called the silent sound killer. Brain tumors were apparently caused by infrasound. Every known malady of man was caused by infrasound. And so that's, people read the headline in the newspaper that'll say infrasound and ghost, but they won't read the bit in between, or they won't read further down the page. And it's the same on paranormal investigation as well. People see how to do a ghost hunt on the television. They form with a group of friends. And to be honest, they're not really doing anything more than going to the movies and having a scary night out. Ghost hunting has become, in the 21st century, the modern equivalent of the family scary movie.
It's a social event. You're absolutely
right. It is a social event. It's pure social event. The internet, Facebook. There are groups, there are people who are doing science, but they are very, very much in the minority. It has become a commercial, social event. It's hopefully it will stop. Hopefully we will get the field back towards or a little bit more to ourselves, so that we can do a little bit more investigation. It would be nice when this bubble bursts and they all perhaps go back to flying saucers or something else.
Well, they're doing that too. So tell me this. Have you ever in your investigations seen or had any reports of what I will call balls of light, not to be confused with orbs, typical dust orbs that we see on pictures, but balls of light that are actually seen with the naked eye?
Well, I'm quite fortunate where I live. I live in West Wales, which is the part of the United Kingdom that's nearest to America. Literally, we stick out into the Atlantic here, and it's a very old part of the world. The Welsh culture and nation has survived pretty well intact for over 2,000 years. And we have out here in Wales a phenomena called the corpse candle, which is very, very similar to American tales of the marsh lights.
Earth lights.
And these, yeah, or the earth lights. These, you've got to forgive me, there's a slight delay on the Skype tonight, so I'm trying to play catch up with you sometimes. The corpse candles have been reported in this part of the world for over 500 years. And they're called corpse candles, not because they hang around graveyards, but they actually precede the route of a funeral, or they act as a portent of death. I've never encountered them personally, but interestingly, I have spoken to a number of elderly people who live in Wales who claim to have seen these over the years as a precursor of death, as a warning, like the Irish have the banshee, the Welsh have the corpse candle.
That's interesting. So have you had cases where people have seen this in their homes, or
No cases that we've ever investigated, but personal accounts when we've talked to people. These people now are quite elderly and tend to be, corpse candles tend to be an outdoor phenomena. They tend to, according to the tradition and folklore, they go ahead of the funeral route a number of days before, or they're seen floating above the building where the person is about to die. And there are indeed people in the village near here who claim to have seen these phenomena.
So what do you make of them?
I think it's a fantastic story, and I'd love to see one. I would, hopefully not my own.
not hovering over your house.
Not hovering over my house. Never look up.
Steve, I want to ask you a question. In all your years of doing this, and everything you've, all the investigations you've conducted, do you feel you've ever encountered the paranormal? And if so, tell us a little bit about what you experienced.
I don't think you could do what I do without encountering the, I'm not going to use the word the paranormal, the unexplainable or the inexplicable. There've been two or three instances that spring to mind. Perhaps the most bizarre took place. The case is on the Parascience website, a quick plug. But we've been there many times, and on this particular occasion, we'd gone there with a small television crew who were doing a documentary piece about the location and the stories associated with the ghostly activity. And we sat there all night, and we were joking with the film crew consisted of two people. There was a news reporter and the cameraman. And we've been sat there all night long with these guys, and they jokingly said, this is going to be like watching paint dry. As we came to lock up in the morning, it was just before dawn, we had the keys to the building, and so we were quite conscious of security. The responsibility for the building was ours. And as we locked up, we noticed that one of the lights in the upstairs offices was still switched on. So giving ourselves a good telling off, we went into the back into the building. As we were re-entering the building, a number of lights were turning themselves on and turning themselves off. And we could hear the sound of movement and doors. We presumed that somebody got in, somebody was playing a prank on the TV crew, on us, and so we were quite keen to get this thing sorted out. We arrived on the first, well, as the Americans would call the second floor, to be confronted by a series of ceiling lights. I should explain that the building, with the room we were in, was a drawing office as part of the shipyard complex, a design office. And the ceiling was divided up into light panels. The room was perhaps 150 feet long, 50 feet wide, and every 10 feet there was a panel in the ceiling that was illuminated only by pulling a switch on a string, on a cord. And we watched as the light panels were alternating between going on, some were going on, some were going off, and we could hear the click of the light panel cords being pulled at the same time. Plus, we could still hear the sound of movement. So we spent a hasty few minutes trying to sort out who was there. We already knew from the time that we'd been there that these light panels could not do this. Unless you pulled the cord, the light panels couldn't go on and off. There was no other switch mechanism for these light panels. And we were left never explaining what happened that night there.
And that's not paranormal? Could that be RSPK?
It could be lots of things, none of which I can explain. So, yeah. there was another occasion. We were doing an investigation at a nearby location. And one of the reason we were there at the, it was an old nightclub, an old sort of drinking club, was that people had reported during a seance that the fire escape doors had exploded open. And this had been caught on a security camera, and we'd seen the footage. And the camera footage from the security camera looked fascinating. But there was one tiny little area, a very small possibility, that somebody could have been hiding behind a piece of scenery and given the door a push. It was very, very difficult, but it could just have been achieved. So we decided to recreate the event and to recreate the situation. And, of course, nothing happened. We then went back a week or two later, and we set up cameras again. And we just finished setting up, and really we were in the post setting up first relaxing phase when everything's quiet for the first time, and the fire escape doors burst open. Now, not when I say that doesn't sound very fantastic, but the fire escape doors were wedged shut with a chair that had been forced into the push bar mechanism. So the push bar mechanism had been inoperable. The doors were held by the chair leg, so the chair was actually lifted up and out of the door mechanism. The first thing we considered was a gust of wind or something outside pulling the doors. The doors had a ceiling strip around them, a metal edge ceiling strip, which prevented people from pulling them or getting any hold on the doors from the outside. And by chance, we'd positioned, I guess you'd call it a trigger object, in front of the doors in the shape of two ping pong balls, which are very, very lightweight, to see if there was a draft coming underneath the fire doors. And on the video, video footage, the ping pong balls don't move at all. So you've got these heavy fire escape doors bursting apart, and there's no possible normal explanation that I can conceive of to explain that.
That is interesting. Here's a question from the chat room from Gemma. The gist of it, you can probably read it too, Steve, is do you think that a poltergeist, noisy spirit, if something moves, if something happens, could it be a poltergeist, she's saying, or he's saying, I'm not sure which, poltergeist, noisy spirit, or could it also be RSPK?
Hi, Gemma. I like this RSPK thing. I think this is a cop-out by parapsychologists. Recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. Well, they say that, according to our psychology friends, our parapsychology friends, that all of this paranormal movement of objects in locations, doors opening as I've just described, objects moving, can be explained by psychokinesis. So that's using one unproven phenomena to explain another. But then they go on to say, well, yes, we understand this happens. The brain generates this huge amount of energy and it, whop, an object moves. Well, if we're dealing with that sort of phenomena where a human mind could generate a huge amount of energy and then cause an object to move, why don't we consider the possibility that the RSPK, if that's the force we're talking about, can be generated by the mind of somebody who's deceased?
Amen.
So, yeah, RSPK, but let's not say it's a prepubescent teenage girl,
right,
or a boy or a disturbed adult. It's just as likely, if that's the cause, if we accept RSPK, then we have to accept it's just as likely from the living as the dead.
And that's one thing we've always taught, too. You know, and RSPK, obviously, from parapsychology, on the part of a human agent, who, as you mentioned, they often say is an adolescent girl, pre, during, post-puberty, primarily, but could be anybody, And, you know, we've always said, well, you know, if anything that moves with anything that is moved by somebody's mind is psychokinesis, also mm-hmm. known as telekinesis, right? So mm-hmm. it is psychokinesis. And we refer to it often as PK. And, you know, the technical term, obviously, I'm just telling some of the people in our listening audience, is RSPK, recurrent spontaneous. But why can't a spirit do it? And if a spirit does it, isn't that, by definition, PK?
If we accept the definition of psychokinesis or telekinesis as defined by Ryan, J.B. Ryan, then we have to accept that if a living mind can achieve that, we can't yet demonstrate that a deceased mind is still not a real force too.
Sure.
And so if the living can do it, then we have to accept the possibility that the mind could also be discarnate or from a dead, you know, deceased as we would understand it.
Right.
I think psychologists are, well, I always say, I've often been said, there are three problems with investigating the paranormal. The first problem is parapsychologists. The second problem is mediums. And the third problem is paranormal investigators.
What are you trying to do? You're trying to...
Well, no, we need to learn a lesson from archaeology and from other sciences. It's a multidisciplinary approach.
Yes.
The discoveries... I work closely with parapsychologists, and a great deal of what they do in the laboratory, I use in field research. But a parapsychologist is a creature of the lab, and parapsychology is about testing psi, which is telepathy, clairvoyance, ESP, etc., etc. What I do, I am a ghost hunter. I don't work in a laboratory. I don't have controlled conditions where I can do double-blind and triple-blind experiments. What I have to try and do is deal with the real world, deal with the chaos, and try and understand the mechanisms that are taking place in that environment. And so, like an archaeologist, I will use psychology. I will draw upon the specialist services of historians, of architects, of engineers, physicists, scientists. It is a multidisciplinary approach. And if we don't approach ghost hunting that way, we're never going to achieve anything. We will never understand it.
You know, I think that you're the first investigator or researcher who has mentioned that, aside from us. We've talked about that a lot on the show, that all these areas overlap. You can't just go with one set or subset of knowledge. You need to know about all of it. I mean, because it overlaps so much, there's similar phenomena, whether you're investigating an abduction case or whether you're investigating paranormal activity, a haunting type stuff. And you've got to be able to draw on those multidisciplinary areas. Good point.
Well, you know, there's so much of it that has to do also with anthropology and, you know, people's beliefs. And it's not just that somebody has weird beliefs because they're just a weird person. They're culturally ingrained in those belief systems a lot of times, you know? And I mean, it's almost an unconscious belief system. So, yeah, the need to have a multidisciplinary approach or disciplined approach to the whole science of investigating a paranormal events is absolutely essential. We really have to go that way.
I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, though, because at the moment we've got investigations, particularly in the UK, where the medium claims to be a skeptic. We've got it's all mixed up. Everybody can be an expert in everything. We've got plumbers who are ghost hunters. we've got all manner of strange situations going on over here and over in the States too. Anybody who can buy a night vision camera, can buy a K2 EMF meter and go and talk to spirits with them, with those crazy EMF meters, and call themselves, and then they present their evidence to the public as We are experts. This is our hard evidence. We know what we're doing. You have to trust us.
Yeah.
And it's
they give
just
us all a bad. It gives everybody a bad name, and you're right, Steve, that we're going to have to overcome that at some point. You know, but I think that you kind of talked about it earlier. I think that they're going to burn out because those folks aren't really interested in the science. And so they lose all credibility after a period of time. And, yeah, you know, they're sensational. And, you know, here in the States, I don't know if the same thing you experience, the same thing in the U.K., is like there's too many paranormal shows right now. There's way too many of them, you know.
There are too many of the wrong sort of show.
Yeah.
Exactly.
We really, I mean, the problem is, let's be honest, how exciting can a real ghost hunt be? Sitting there doing not very much. If you don't have a medium running around screaming, oh my God, there's four horsemen, the apocalypse have just run through the room, nobody's gonna watch the show, you're not going to sell any adverts, and they're not going to make the program.
That's true.
And but demons are big business, too.
Demons, they're huge at the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody over here wants to be an exorcist. What's that all about?
Hey, we should start an exorcism course, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Probably sell out. And I
all we
got to
do is just shave a few steaks and, you know, and garlic garlands.
And I want to a point.
You realize you've probably just started the next TV craze, don't you?
I want to make a point, too, on what you're saying, you know, that everybody feels like they can. And the interesting thing about our world and all of this is that, yes, it is open to everybody. And that's the whole point of Paranexus Universe Radio is it's designed and aimed at researchers and at those who would do this kind of thing. So if you are listening to the live program or you're listening to the archive, there's nothing wrong with doing it. But take the advice that you've been given by Steve and by many others on this program and really be serious about it. It's not a thrill hunt. It's not a weekend warrior type of thing. It's something that we're trying to figure out because it impacts the human condition. The ultimate meaning is huge one way or another, whether we prove it, you know, the life after death exists or not. Either way,
and
it's got incredible meaning for humanity.
And every great scientific discovery and breakthrough has been made by amateurs.
Yes.
The scientists have come along later. So there is a huge scope here for us to move this subject forward and for real, you know, normal amateur people, amateur enthusiasts like us, to move this on. But we need to look at what we're doing. We need to look at the way we're doing it.
Yes. And with that, we're going to have to start wrapping it up because our time is almost gone. Steve, you've been great. I know you've stayed up late. And, you know, if you're crazy again in the future,
great.
We'd like to have you back.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back. Maybe next time you come back, we can do a 90-minute segment, you know, because
yeah, it's been a real
blast. I'm sure our audience would love to hear some more.
Yes, indeed. And I'd like to tell our listeners, if you haven't had a chance to visit Paranexus.org, please do so. We would love to have you join us. Paranexus is a nonprofit association for researchers. We try to support you. We cover all of it, not just the haunting aspect, but all of it, including ufology, parapsychology, even a little cryptozoology. So come and join us at Paranexus.org if you're looking for courses. ParanexusAcademy.org is a great place to learn about normal. I know we've got an EVP course being developed. It's coming out before too long by Dr. Ingrid Irwin, so be on the lookout for that. Plus, we just added a new course on hypnosis that's free to members, so take a look at Paranexus Academy. And also, just a couple of quick announcements. Grant, the almighty Grant Man, has, along with cooperation of me, has appointed Sharon as our executive producer. What that means, nobody really knows, but she is now our executive producer, and we're happy to have her because she's done a bang-up job on scheduling. In fact, scheduled Steve. So we recognize Sharon for all her hard work. And also, if you're a Paranexus member, go to the forum. And I know that I'm going to try to say this real quick because we're running out of time, but in a few months, the old courthouse in Bartow, Florida, is opening up their location to 35 investigators in the area, and you can go and do it. We're going to be there. It's co-hosted by Paranexus. There's more information on Paranexus.org. Steve, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
No, it's been my pleasure. Really good night.
And we will
Morning.
See you next week. I'll be sitting in for Gregory on Psychic Perspective. Everybody have a great night.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.